Ladies and gentlemen, hopefully this will be the last time someone from the 21st century speaks to you this evening. My name is Robert Lipschutz, and I have the honor of representing Colonel Edward Townsend, who was the acting adjutant general of the United States Army during the Civil War. What I'm going to do now is to use my power to bend space and time and bring us back to Wednesday, May 17th, 1865. The war over barely a month ago, and then a few days later, President Lincoln being assassinated, his burial not even 2 weeks old. What will happen now is I have the honor of presenting the men who worked to win this war and to preserve the Union, and they will introduce themselves briefly to you so as to give you, for the remaining time, an opportunity to ask questions of us. We will be here throughout this program and afterward, and we are always available to you. I understand, though, that in the future there will be some type of device that will allow you to communicate through the air somehow. And through this device, you may wish to look at something called UnionGenerals.org. And that is some type of bulletin board of some kind, apparently, through which you can learn about our organization. And with that, thank you very much. And one by one, the gentlemen to my right and ladies to my right will introduce themselves.
Okay, at this point. Good evening. My name is John George Nicolay. I am not a general or colonel, but I do serve the commander-in-chief. I was President Lincoln's private secretary. I was born in Bavaria and immigrated to the United States when I was 6 years old. I was a newspaper man for several years, joined the presidential campaign, and then became his private secretary working in the executive mansion. And if I may ask, the Emancipation Proclamation that you have in your resources, if it's the one that was sold in the Great Central Fair in 1864, you will see my signature there with the president's and secretary of state stamp.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think I need this strange device of unknown origin. Major General George G. Meade, and I might say that I probably am, with the exception of my comrade here, was born in Philadelphia, the only Philadelphian on this panel. I was also a paying member of the Historical Society. So I suppose I have more right to be here than anybody. But I was a West Point graduate, a noted engineer, having designed, built, or supervised the construction of 10 lighthouses, three of them in the New Jersey coast. Before the war, a Mexican War veteran as staff engineer to General Zachary Taylor. At the beginning of the Civil War, already in advanced age of 46, I did request a combat command. I had never really commanded troops. I was a staff officer and an engineer. But was assigned to one of the brigades of the Pennsylvania Reserve Corps, essentially the origin of our Pennsylvania National Guard. I saw service with the Pennsylvania Reserves through most of the early part of the war until I was promoted on the very eve of the greatest and most pivotal battle in American history up to that time. I was promoted to command the Union Army of the Potomac at the Battle of Gettysburg, where I was able to defeat the insurgent forces under his command of the Confederacy, and my old comrade from the Army, Robert E. Lee. There is Meade after Gettysburg, and I remained in command of the Army until the end of the war, although for various reasons I don't receive the credit for the work I did, and the man who does receive the credit is what became President of the United States, and he's on a $50 bill. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, George. I'm Major General George Henry Thomas. I was born in Newsom Depot, Virginia. My family was slave owners. I'm a slave owner. Attended West Point, graduated in 1840. Knew George for a long, long time, right, George? We served together in Mexico and also in the Seminole Wars. So graduated in 1840 from West Point. I am commander of the Department and Army of the Cumberland.
How do you do? I am Major General John Gibbon. Has my distinguished former commander mentioned, I'm also from Philadelphia. I all know that the city itself, a small village called Holmesburg, north of here. My family was 7 years old. We moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. My father, having secured a lucrative position down there with the U.S. Mint. I was appointed to West Point at the age of 18, graduated in 1847. I was supposed to graduate in 46, but that's another story. Served in the artillery before the war almost exclusively, and at the time of the war was in the Utah Territory when we were all called back east. And I was assigned a chief of staff to General Irwin McDowell to advise him on artillery matters, as I was a recognized expert, having authored the Artillerist Manual in 1859 when I was assistant artillery instructor at West Point. I was also given a field command of my own upon my promotion to Brigadier General. It was comprised mainly of Western units. Initially it was called the Western Brigade or the Black Hat Brigades because morale, these boys were unusually rowdy, has discipline problems, even in an all-volunteer army. They later became the Iron Brigade, an outfit which to this day I am proud to have commanded. After that I commanded the 1st Division, the 2nd Division in the 1st Corps. I was wounded at Fredericksburg, and upon my recovery, I was given command of the 2nd Division, 2nd Corps. It was under that command that I stopped Pickett's charge on the third day at Gettysburg. After this, I was wounded again at Gettysburg, took some time to recover, was one of the few general officers present that had the advantage of hearing our great, beloved president's speech that day when the National Cemetery was dedicated. I continued with the 2nd Division. After taking a sick leave and returning to duty in 1864, in December, I was appointed commander of the 24th Corps, Army of the James. Leading that corps, in early April, we managed to cut off Fitzhugh Lee's retreat, that's Robert E. Lee's nephew, from the Appomattox vicinity, and force his uncle to go and talk to my then commander-in-chief, General Grant. I'm glad to have partaken in that event that stopped the war, or at least stopped it in most people's minds. There were still other Confederate armies in the field, as I'm sure most of you are aware, but none with the force and prestige of the Army of Northern Virginia. Now, I'm in command of the Military District of Petersburg, as we are in May of 1865. Thank you.
Thank you, General Gibbon. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I am so glad that you are here.
I am.
Major General Nathaniel P. Banks of Massachusetts. Great to be here. My history is a little bit different from my comrades in that I am a political appointee general. I served in the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. as a representative from Waltham, Massachusetts in 1848. Now, in 1852, we separated from the Democratic Party and formed this brand new party, which some of you may have heard. It's called the Republican Party. And in 1854, I was elected Speaker of the House. And I served for several years. Now, as I was eyeing the presidency for the 1860 election, I decided that it might behoove me to run for governor of Massachusetts. So I went back to my home state, and I was elected for 2 terms in Massachusetts as governor. Of course, it was a 1-year term each. Now, when my dear friend, Abe Lincoln, got the primary for the election, it was disappointing. So I got a job in Chicago as heading up, the Illinois Railroad. I did that for several months until I got a communique from President Lincoln asking if I would be willing to become a major general in the Army of Volunteers. I immediately accepted, and I received my commission on May 14th, 1861, and I was assigned as the commander of Annapolis. Months later, I became the commander of the Shenandoah, where I chased a very formidable foe up and down the Shenandoah Valley. You may know him from his nickname of Stonewall Jackson. After that, I was made the commander of the Gulf, and I was sent down to Louisiana, to New Orleans. where I did some pretty good work and departed on some campaigns to take Texas. Unfortunately, due to some miscalculations and, I'm afraid, a lack of experience, I did not do so well. I was returned back to New Orleans. I was brought up to Washington, D.C. for a while to help lobby Congress to get the two congressmen from Louisiana seated in Congress. Unfortunately, I failed that. I went back to New Orleans just last month, and now I'm in a situation where I am no longer the commander of the Gulf. Rather, I have a Major General Canby, who I work for. I have been pigeonholed. So it is with deep regret that within a few days, I will be resigning from the Army, and I will return to Waltham, Massachusetts, and resume my political career. Thank you.
Politicians.
I heard that.
The boys are still weary.
Long-winded. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Brigadier General Henry Jackson Hunt. I'm Chief of Artillery of the Army of the Potomac. I'm a West Point graduate, class of 1839. I'm a career artillery officer. Unlike Generals Gibbon, Meade, and Thomas, I'm a veteran of the Mexican War. I served under the command of General Winfield Scott. In September of 1862, I was promoted to Chief of Artillery of the Army of the Potomac. At the time, I was commanding the Artillery Reserve. I held the rank of colonel. Upon the resignation from that post of my good friend, General Bill Barry, William Barry, he decided to take a job at the War Department. I was called into a meeting just days before the Battle of Antietam with General McClellan. He says, "Henry, Bill Barry is going to the War Department. I need a new artillery chief. Would you like the job?" I very nearly turned it down. Being a chief of artillery sounds a lot more glamorous than it actually is. Prior to my taking the post, the artillery chief was largely an administrator and an advisor. The commanding general would decide, "I'm going to post the guns thusly on the field of battle. Do you agree or do you disagree?" And you're there to point out alternatives. I was not content with that. I decided to push things a little bit with General McClellan. I said, "Sir, I'm a career artillery officer. I've never done anything else from the time I graduated the point. If I were to take this position, it would be only on the condition that I be given tactical authority over the guns." I fully expected General McClellan to say no. Much to my surprise, he said, "All right, Henry, they're yours. Command them as you see fit." I held the position of Chief of Artillery under each successive general commanding the Army after General McClellan. I held this position till the end of the war.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Brigadier General Horace Porter. I'll start off with my grandfather, Andrew Porter. During the American Revolutionary War, at the beginning of the war, he was a widow with five children and was noted for a gallant action at Germantown by General Washington and was put on General Washington's staff as a general. During the war, he married his second wife and had five more children, of which one was my father, David Rittenhouse Porter. He was the governor of Pennsylvania from 1839 to 1845. I was born in Huntington, Pennsylvania. One of David Porter's half-sisters became grandmother to a young lady by the name of Mary Todd. I attended West Point, graduated in 1860, third in my class. I was an ordnance expert. one of the best things that happened at West Point was during one of the spring dances, I met a very attractive young lady, Miss Sophie, and she and I married during the war in 1863. That's my lovely wife here. During the war, I served on the staff of seven different officers. I never held a command of action anywhere, but I was a staff officer, mostly in charge of ordnance and artillery for various Union positions from the East Coast out to the Western Front. The last officer that I was staff officer for was, I was aide-de-camp to General Grant. And I took possession of that job April of 1864, and I stayed with General Grant across the Overland Campaign clear to Appomattox. Upon the surrender of General Lee, we immediately returned to Washington. We have over a million men that we had to demobilize and get home. And we knew that, and we also had the reconstruction that President Lincoln wanted to instigate. And we had the military districts that we had to control down in the South until the states got back into the Union. So primarily after Appomattox until after the funeral of President Lincoln, General Grant and I have been very busy demobilizing and doing an awful lot of paperwork in Washington City.
Good evening. I am Major Jonathan Letterman of Pennsylvania. I graduated Jefferson Medical College right here in Philadelphia. After graduating medical school, I served several years in the military service on the frontiers, where I learned the importance of diet to keep troops healthy, and particularly that fresh fruits and vegetables are necessary to prevent scurvy, which was one of our greatest problems, and this knowledge served me very well subsequently. Sometime after the War of the Rebellion began, I was appointed Chief Medical Officer of the Army of the Potomac. At that time, the conditions of the medical service and health care in general for the Union armies, and for that matter, these Confederate armies likewise, was rather terrible. Regimental surgeons came right out of civilian life and were poorly trained and had no experience in the type of injuries they were seeing. There was no organized, the diets were very poor, and sanitation standards were almost non-existent, and intestinal diseases were rampant. There was no organized system for handling battlefield wounded, and after a major battle, wounded would remain on the battlefield unattended and unevacuated sometimes for days. I completely reorganized the healthcare system for the Army of the Potomac, including fresh fruits and vegetables and sanitation standards, which dramatically reduced the incidence of intestinal diseases and almost eliminated scurvy. I reorganized the medical services, including a professional ambulance corps under the direction of the medical service. I reorganized the system of regimental surgeons to put in field dressing stations and field hospitals with triage and transportation. This system reduced deaths due to battlefield injuries by 65 to 70%, and this system was subsequently adopted by all Union armies and has been very successful. This system will in the future be adopted by all armies in the world. It will in fact become the standard military operating system for all armies in the world in the future. In the future, I will become known as the father of military medicine and one of the fathers of emergency medicine. Thank you.
Good evening. As you can see, I look a little different than the rest of them. My name is Dr. Mary Walker. I was raised in a very unusual family in Oswego, New York. That's where I was born. And it was unusual because my father really believed that women were equal to men. And in that day, that was a very unusual idea back then, and it continues to be even at this present time. But my lifelong goal has been attempting to prove that women are equal to men. I went to medical school. I got married. When my husband decided that he wanted multiple women in his life, I separated from him, and I decided to volunteer to work in the Civil War. I had to volunteer. There was no way that any of the male physicians or anyone that was in the military was willing to accept a woman physician. Eventually, I somewhat proved myself, but only as a volunteer. They would not give me any sort of commission or any contract. I worked in many hospitals. I worked in field hospitals. I was in multiple battles, including Fredericksburg. I continued to petition to get a commission because I was doing the same work as all the male physicians. Eventually, though, there was an opening, and General Thomas, who was also a more open thinking, was willing to give me, take a chance and give me the position and gave me a contract to work outside of Chattanooga. I got a contract, but under no circumstances was I given a commission. Even petitioning to President Lincoln multiple times, he wrote a letter back to me saying that no way would he get involved with this and would not give me a commission. I was accused by the Confederates of spying during the war, as well as working as a physician, and I was imprisoned for 4 months in one of the worst Confederate prisons in Richmond. I survived. I lost over half my vision during that period of time. Really one of my worst experiences, but I was exchanged actually for a captain from the Confederacy, and I continued my work during the war after I left it. In the next few months, in November, I have heard that President Johnson will award me the Congressional Medal of Honor. Looking into the future, I will say I am the only woman ever to have been awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor.
I'm Chaplain Lance, Philadelphia Life Recovery Battery A, and militia, part of a militia designed to protect Philadelphia from the Confederate forces. I served there until late 1863, our battery was dissolved. I joined the 215th Union Regiment as a private, served there until the end of the war. And this is my beautiful bride.
I am Catherine F. Reynolds Landis. I am here to speak for my brother, who you would know as Major General John Fulton Reynolds. He cannot be with us today as he gave up his life on the field of battle in Gettysburg, July 1st, commanding the left wing of the Army of the Potomac for General Meade. He was career Army, graduated West Point in 41, and he would serve from the day he graduated to the day he died 22 years later. He served in the Mexican War and in posts from Maine to Florida and from Virginia to California and Oregon and Washington State. He was commissioned in the 3rd U.S. Artillery, and in the summer of 1860, he was called back to West Point. He had hoped for a teaching position, but he got way more than that. He was made commandant of cadets, and he was teaching tactics and artillery, cavalry, and infantry, and also teaching 40 and 50 men at a time to ride the artillery horses. And he's in charge of discipline. So I have a list of his classes. He had 5 classes a day with assistant professors. And then when the war was breaking out, he was offered a position as chief of staff on General Winfield Scott's staff, but he did not want to be tied to a desk. So he was made a Brigadier General of Volunteers in August of 1861. He would be active with the Pennsylvania Reserve, teaching volunteer troops, as he also did in Mexico. And a lot of the regular Army guys had thought the volunteers would fight, but he trained them into shock troops. And like today, we have a volunteer army. They're there because they chose it. So he was offered command of the Army of Potomac 2 times. The first time after Burnside's Mud March in February of 1862. He turned it down because President Lincoln did not offer him a free hand from the politicians. And then he would be again offered it June 1st, 1863. Again, he turned it down for the same reasons. He wrote home that the only way he would take the command is if he was ordered to do so. The command was then forced on General Meade. And General Meade and he met together that very day, and General Meade put him in charge of the left wing of the Army, 1st, 3rd, and 11th Corps, and Buford's two cavalry divisions. We knew from his letters in the past that he believed in commanding from on the field, which was scary for us at home, because we knew the dangers he was in. In June of 1862, during the 7 days campaign of the First Peninsular Campaign, he was captured at Gaines Mills. He was doing personal reconnaissance at the end of the day, and then he and his aide, Charles Kingsbury, were cut off from returning back to their troops. So they hid out in the swamp because both of their horses were wounded. They were captured in the morning, and he spent 6 weeks in Libby prison. But to show you how poor the communications were back then, how we found out about it was my husband in Philadelphia here, we lived on 1800 block of Spruce Street. He went to pick up the morning papers, and the New York Herald paper reported General John F. Reynolds as killed. So Harry grabbed some clothes and jumped on the first train for Washington City, and he says, I'm going to get to the bottom of this because we hadn't heard anything. And 3 days later, we got a telegram that says, John is in prison alive, not killed as reported. So you can imagine how that must have felt if you've ever had anybody in the military in harm's way. Next time we wouldn't be so lucky. But his actions, the weeks leading up to Gettysburg, were to watch for where, try to figure out where the Confederate troops were going to come through, because he knew that they were coming in, heading north again.
No, she's not filming.
And he and Buford had been in constant touch with each other. Buford had gone into Gettysburg a couple days before, and he reported that the Confederates were as close as Cashtown. Buford's last dispatch would come to John at his headquarters about 6 miles below Gettysburg, about between 10 and 10:30 at night, and John would send Major Riddle on a horse to General Meade's headquarters in Maryland to tell him that they were coming right away. General Meade's orders came to John 4 a.m. in the morning on July 1st. It was with a view to advance on Gettysburg and take the first corps up out of the 11th corps to support, and the third corps was the furthest away to have them immediately coming up. So he rode into Gettysburg twice that morning, actually. The first time when he got up there, he and Buford rode, although Buford was already engaged, and he decided what to do about the situation, because it was up to him as the wing commander. It was not up to Buford whether to stay or not. John decided this was an important hub of roads and that it needed to be held. Then he rode back down to hurry the First Corps onto the field. He placed regiments himself to relieve Buford's troopers and whole Second Main Battery he put on the field himself. And then as he was pushing the Second Wisconsin in the woods to keep Archer's brigade from flanking the Buford's troops, he was shot and killed. Again, the New York Herald, this printed something. They reported him killed by a sharpshooter, and now it's established that he caught an overshoot from a volley from Archer's brigade. It was either the 7th or the 14th Tennessee. And it also killed his aide's horse at the same time. And I've gotten into the reports of the First Corps surgeon that said he lived as long as 15 minutes, though he was probably paralyzed. So the Union Army lost a very valuable soldier that day. And he was brought to our home here on Spruce Street and laid out. My husband was not home. He was in action up towards Carlisle. And Early morning of July 4th, the Pennsylvania Railroad provided a car, free transport, to take him to our family plot in Lancaster, where he is today. Back then, in those days, your family would be laid out in the front parlor of your house. And my firstborn son, who we named up from John Fulton Reynolds Landis, was very affected by this. He really worshipped his uncle. He was going to the military and had a lifelong career in the military. He graduated West Point in 1878 and served all the way into World War I.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you can see, we have quite a distinguished group before us. I hope you will take this opportunity to direct questions to them, because these truly, truly are the men and women who won the war. Madam? Wait, please wait until you have a microphone.
First of all, on behalf of all of us assembled here, thank you for your service. Thank you for your constancy through hard times and for being present here tonight. General Thomas, I have a question. I understand that command of the Army of the Potomac had been offered to you perhaps more than once, but you turned it down. Can you give us your reasons if that's true?
Why would anyone want to command the Army of the Potomac?
My question, my answer.
And that is verbatim. To be that close to Washington just had no attraction for me whatsoever. Truth be told, I was early on commissioned as a Brigadier General of Volunteers, and I took that commission as an opportunity to raise my own army. I am the only commander of an army who saw it from its beginning right up through the end of the war. With the exception of one break after Shiloh, I immediately requested I be returned back to my corps. So I was happy with my assignment. I was happy with those who served under me, and I saw no reason to leave that position.
Have nothing to do with your being Virginian?
No, madam, nothing at all. I was, as I said, I was born in Virginia. From my earliest recollection, I love being a Virginian. I love being a Virginian in 1861, and I love being a Virginian in 1865. I did not, as they say, stay loyal to the Union. That was my job. If anything, in 1861, Virginia left me, or at least part of it. So,
you like Army. You like the Army.
Yeah. Are there any other questions? Sir?
A lot of Virginians here. One distinguished Virginian who was not at the table was Stonewall Jackson, who lost his life in the military confrontation just before Gettysburg. Did that influence his absence? Influence your decisions from the general staff?
My decision to...
Could you repeat that?
Asking the general.
General Jackson.
Well, General Jackson.
General, you're asking me?
Yes, General.
Oh, okay. Well, he couldn't... He had nothing to do with Stonewall Jackson because he was serving in a different theater of operations. So I served against General Jackson, but I see no carryover. He died, I understand, of his wound on May the 10th, 1863. He was shot by his own men at Chancellorsville. That's right. Something that happens sometimes. Right. General Longstreet was also shot by his own men later in the war. We never had any reason to make any decisions based on either who was on that side or who was not. So no, I mean, I lost General Reynolds. The best commander in the Union Army was lost on the first day of the Battle of Gettysburg, yet I had to continue to command the Army to ultimate end with the, of course, the realization that should we have lost that battle, it may have ended in separation into two nations. And therefore, it was an immense burden of responsibility on my shoulders. But was I thinking about individual commanders? No, I was only worried about plugging gaps in the line.
Thank you.
You, sir.
More questions? This time, on the subject of Southerners or people with Southern roots serving in the Union Army, I have a question of General Gibbon. Did you have any feelings about the fact that the person you were fighting on the third day of the Battle of Gettysburg was a relative of yours?
Well, I think what Colonel Townsend is referring to, what most of you know of as Pickett's Charge, was actually composed of elements of three Confederate divisions. One was under George Pickett, the other was under a gentleman who had just been promoted to divisional command and was very inexperienced, which is why he did not play a major role in the attack. That was, my cousin, first cousin, I should say, Johnston Pettigrew, who was before the war a lawyer in Charleston, South Carolina, kept very close touch with my mother and father. He was one of my mother's dearest cousins. And he was actually against secession, but when his state seceded, he stayed with it. Now, in my case, even though North Carolina had seceded, and I considered myself from North Carolina, but when we all camped floored, some of the Southern officers instantly announced their intention to go, and they wanted to take me with them because of my fame as the author of the Artillerist Manual. And what they wanted for me was to go with them and swear an oath of allegiance to something called the Confederacy. I told them that I saw no need to swear an oath of allegiance because I had already sworn.
Sir.
Did any of you gentlemen have the honor to fight the Philadelphia general who was in the Confederacy, Pemberton?
No. Let's talk. Are you with Vicksburg?
Nope.
No.
Nobody was in Vicksburg.
My best friend is it when we were young boys.
Pardon?
He was my best friend. We went to school together in early life. So, of course, he served in the Union Army up until, but made the mistake of marrying South. So I think he went reluctantly along into the Confederacy. That's my opinion.
I think that most of us, if I may add to what General Meade said, most of us have friends from our days in the old Army, wearing the other uniform. In 1861, it was a very difficult thing to say goodbye to old friends, knowing that we would be possibly facing one another across an empty space one day. The first time I was ever fired upon by a friend, I found out after the fact. In 1861, I was part of the relief expedition to Fort Pickens in Pensacola Bay. It was a situation very much like Fort Sumter. Unlike Fort Sumter being in a harbor, Fort Pickens was out in the bay off the coast of Florida, and Pickens remained in our hands throughout the entire war. It was very much a thorn in the side of the Confederacy having that fort remain with the Stars and Stripes flying over it. Our ship, the America, came under fire from the shore batteries as we approached the fort. I later found out that those batteries were under the command of my old friend Braxton Bragg. Now, for those of you who may know something about Braxton Bragg, Bragg is a very difficult man to like. He could probably count his friends on one hand. I'm one. I'm not sure who the other four are. But I recall thinking to myself, Bragg, You haven't many friends in this world. Can you afford to be shooting at the ones that you do have? Of course, he probably had no way of knowing he had no way of knowing that I was aboard the America. Perhaps he did because he owed me money from a card game. So that may have had something to do with it, but I think each of us at one time or another thought about friends wearing the other uniform.
I consider them all to be traitors.
Yes. One thing you should know is that not all people who were Southerners left. Obviously, we had General Thomas. We had General Gibbon, who, although born in Philadelphia, was raised in North Carolina. Although I spent most of my time in the office of the Adjutant General, from the period of March 7th of 1861 through November 1st, I was chief of staff to Lieutenant General Winfield Scott, General-in-Chief of the United States Army. He was a Virginian. His family owned a plantation. But he stayed loyal to the Union. And at his direction, on the 18th of May, 1861, I summoned Colonel Robert Lee to the office of General Scott. With so many people leaving the United States Army and going south, he inquired of Colonel Lee what his plans were. He said, well, were I to remain with the Union, my property would be confiscated. I would leave my children destitute, so I'm leaving. Now bear in mind, this man was probably one of the finest officers in the U.S. Army. He had been superintendent of West Point. But in loyalty to his property and his children, he forsake the oath he swore. Now, the home that he had and the property that he had was very important, because you have to understand that his home overlooked Washington, D.C., where rebel artillery to be placed there, the entire city could have been devastated. So in response to his actions, the Union rather preemptively took it over, and that is now where Arlington National Cemetery is. Ma'am?
I have a couple questions, but I have one for Dr. Walker. I know you were very brave and you went to prison, but your work after that period was so influential and something to be memorized, memorable in Washington, when you helped the families of the soldiers who were streaming into the city. How did you get involved in that?
Yeah, when I first joined the war, I volunteered in the Patton office, which was one of the hospitals in Washington, with a great deal of difficulty accepting me. What I noticed when I was there is that that there was no system in place where wives or mothers of the wounded could either figure out where the wounded were located in which hospital, and the wives and mothers, when they came to visit, really had no place to stay. At that point, if a woman was unaccompanied by a male, she was considered to be a prostitute. So that she was not allowed to stay in any hotel, she was not allowed to stay in any boarding home, and so the women who came to try to visit their wounded loved ones, they were sleeping on park benches, they were staying in the streets because no one would accept them. And I found that completely unacceptable. I went to the politicians in Washington City. I got some people involved and raised the money, and I bought a home there. And I opened this home so that these women who were visiting and unaccompanied had a place where they could stay and wait and take care of their wounded and have their children with them. I also worked with the politicians in Washington to organize a system which was not in place so that it could be recorded in one location to know which hospital the wounded were located, and that actually became quite effective in place. But the main thing was how women were treated during that period of time and the support that they needed.
Thank you. I have a question for Dr. Letterman. How did your relationship develop with the Sanitary Commission? How did your relationship develop with the Sanitary Commission? I mean, that was kind of a new idea also, and you were so progressive, and they were so not welcomed.
Yeah, we received a great deal of support from the Sanitary Commission, and they were instrumental in improving the health standards, in particular, of the soldiers. They provided us some services, they provided us material, they provided us support, and in many cases they provided leadership, particularly in some of the hospitals in some of the cities where this was needed. It was a very interesting situation. By the way, Philadelphia was one of the cities where but the Sanitary Commission was very strong. And my wife, Mary Letterman, in the front row, was very active. Was in the Sanitary Commission.
So was my wife.
So I can't say enough to praise their efforts. They were also instrumental in making sure that we had fresh fruits and vegetables. At the time, it became clear that what was being provided. We've known for about 20 years from the British Navy. That scurvy could be prevented with fruits and vegetables. What we've been providing is vegetables that are dehydrated, compressed, and canned. And I knew from my experience in the West that this did not work, that this did not prevent scurvy. So in the future you're going to know why, but I can't tell you that right now because we don't know. But it has something to do with water-soluble vitamins. I'm not sure what that means. But at any rate, I convinced the Sanitary Commission that fresh fruits and vegetables were necessary. They responded by making sure they were provided, in many cases providing them themselves, and we in fact eliminated scurvy that way from the armies, which was a serious disease. And I knew from my experience that for every man that was sick with scurvy and not reporting for duty, two others were affected by it and not effective. So I think they were, in that way and many other ways, this, I can't say enough to praise the Sanitary Commission.
Thank you.
Mrs. Porter, you mentioned to me a little bit earlier today of donations coming in from unusual sources to the Sanitation Commission. Could you just list a few of those places?
Thank you. I think he's referring to the quilts that different groups of women made throughout the North for the U.S. Sanitary Commission to be distributed to the different soldiers. They included a girls' school group in Massachusetts. Also, a group of ladies from other churches provided those quilts. And one particular quilt was made by supposedly two anonymous ladies here in Philadelphia, I believe, and they made a red and white and blue quilt, but they sent squares, muslin squares, to various politicians and other officers and other notables of that time to sign them. And then they took those squares and they put them into this quilt and donated it to the Philadelphia U.S. Sanitary Commission Fair that they had here in 1864, and it was raffled off to raise money for the U.S. Sanitary Commission. And one of the signatures was Abraham Lincoln and General Grant and a number of others that I won't go into right now. But it's on display at Ford's Theater right now in Washington. So thank you.
Yeah. Let me see. All right, sir. Wait. Before let that new bangled contraption meet you first.
Really, for any of the panel, for any of the panelists, what practical impact in terms of governance of the country did any of you have to encounter after the assassination of Lincoln? Or did you have to do anything?
Well, now, you have to understand, sir, we were all military men at that point. Now, many people went on to have distinguished careers in politics, But
no, I understand that, but I am asking at the time of the assassination if any of you had to take any actions or if there was anything dealing practical or political with the governance of the country. Well, maybe it's the secretary.
There was a concern of General Grant that his soldiers may take revenge on the Southerners in the southern cities. That was a concern. And Secretary of War Stanton, in addition to all the other things he tackled in April, such as getting testimony from the witnesses in the Peterson House, making sure the government continued, making sure Vice President Johnson is brought up to speed, even though he was not in the executive mansion. He was still working out of his office in the Treasury building. I think Secretary of War Stanton and General U.S. Grant were the ones who were really going in, taking care of the issues that you were worried about. For the most part, the government of and the policies that Abraham Lincoln had put together was still functioning and just running as it should, just like a locomotive going down the track. There is nothing really to do because the war was effectively over. So that was what we had, as well as there was a transition. I myself was going to be a consul in Paris. Private Secretary John Hay had a similar position. So the administration was changing over, but there was no unrest or upheavals to really report of.
The biggest concern field commanders have would have been a re-energized Confederacy. And fortunately, that never came about. We were certainly in a position to deal with that if it did, but the South had been so ground into the dust by that point, there was just it just never materialized.
I think the reports that came back in after the assassination really kind of astounded a lot of the military leaders and politicians in Washington City, in that I think the Southern people realized that the surrender terms that came about were giving the best to the South, and hopefully the good reconstruction would come about. And so I think they were very upset and disappointed in Mr. Booth and the assassination.
Sir, wait till the microphone comes. I understand that's what they call this newfangled thing.
Malaria and yellow fever are endemic to that part of Virginia where a lot of the battles were taking place. Do you have experience with malaria and yellow fever among the troops?
We have considerable experience, particularly with malaria, and it's very interesting because the treatment for malaria that we developed could also be used as a prevention. We know that quinine is effective in many cases in treating malaria. When we started moving Union armies into some areas that are malaria infested swamps, where such as around Vicksburg, for example, it became a particular problem for the Union armies, more so than the Confederates, many of whom had already experienced it. We tried giving quinine as a preventive measure, and we discovered that it was effective and that it worked. And it became almost standard, which was very interesting because this violates what we know as medical principles, and that is balance of the humors to restore health. Quinine is not known to do any of that, and as a matter of fact, it is not known to be effective against anything except malaria. This violates some of what we know about medicine, so we called it a specific. that is a medication that is specific to a specific condition. So it not only was effective in preventing malaria in most cases, but it was also a new finding in medicine. And subsequent to that, more and more specifics were to be found, and eventually it would cause us to discard much of what we then call classical medicine. As far as yellow fever is concerned, we know the yellow fever is contagious. We don't really know right now exactly how or why. Diseases are spread by some factor that probably is related to the odor, which we call miasma. We don't know what this factor is, but we know the yellow fever is very contagious. So, I would like to describe one interesting aspect of it, and that is during the war, a Confederate physician and some Confederate agents were very upset that most of the war was occurring in the South, and they wanted to do something to affect the North. So there was a yellow fever epidemic occurring in Bermuda. So they sent some agents to Bermuda to purchase clothing and blankets from infected patients, brought those clothing and blankets to New York, and sold them as secondhand clothing in an attempt to start a yellow fever epidemic in New York. It didn't work. We don't know why. In the future, you're going to know why. But we don't know why it didn't work. But yellow fever apparently can't be spread that way. But it's just an interesting tangent.
But they weren't the leading causes of death. Pneumonia and dysentery were the leading causes of death during that period of time. There was also an awful lot of smallpox. And what was said, a smallpox vaccine was available. And if you were in the city, you could be inoculated. But most of the young men who were on the battlefield came from the country, and they knew nothing about it and never were inoculated. Well, or knew little about it, I believe, and did die from the disease as a result.
Yes, smallpox was a problem. And we do have a vaccine against smallpox. The problem with the vaccine against smallpox is, in order to make it, and you have to make it fresh, on site, you need infected children. and you have to prepare the vaccine from lesions of the infected children. And these are just not available on battlefield sites. In fact, our biggest problem in smallpox in the armies is just the opposite, and that is surreptitious vaccinations. We don't like to use adults to make the vaccine, because we cannot distinguish smallpox lesions from tertiary syphilis lesions. And in too many cases, when vaccines have been prepared from adults, we have caused syphilis. And syphilis can't be treated. There's no known treatment. So so we don't want to use adult lesions to treat syphilis. So for that reason, there's and also the volume of soldiers, hundreds of thousands. Even if children were available, there's no way we can get that many vaccines and that many for that many. With legions for that many. So there was actually no practical way that armies could be vaccinated against smallpox. Even in the civilian world, it's not always possible.
Now, all these men were in the field for the vast majority of the war, and I'm sure it had a personal toll taken on many of them. And certainly, if you have any questions about that, please feel free to ask. I want to ask General Thomas, if I could, what happened to his lands and his family relationships, considering that he was a Virginian?
When the war broke out, I telegraphed my family in Virginia that I was staying loyal to the Union, and I notified my wife in Troy, New York. I would never see my family again, at least my sisters, Frances and Annie. The only communication I would have with them, they sent me a letter asking me to change my name. I tried to provide for them financially during the war. All attempts to do that were rebuked. I did maintain a relationship with my brother Benjamin in Vicksburg. As I said, I was a slave owner. I had procured a slave, a housekeeper, if you will, for my wife when we were in Texas. In 1860, I had a leave. I sent it with my brother in Vicksburg for safekeeping. It was still my responsibility to provide for her under the law, which I did. I sent him money regularly to take care of her husband, and her children. Once the war was ended, my responsibility under the law was over, and we never had any communication. communication, at least that I had communication with her after that fact. My brother and I reconciled to some degree, but it was always strained.
Now, as you might imagine, among these strong personalities, there were occasional differences of opinion from time to time. And I understand that on the third day of the Battle of Gettysburg, there was some conflict between General Hunt and General Hancock. Unfortunately, General Hancock is not here to speak for him, but I'm sure that General Hunt will give a fair and even-handed discussion of what happened.
You can count on it, sir. People are always asking me about a controversy regarding General Hancock and myself. For the record, I am not aware of any controversy. I am right, he is wrong, and that's all there is to it. No controversy at all. What Colonel Townsend is referring to is during the cannonade, which preceded the rebel assault on our positions on the the center of the line. General Hancock differed from me when I ordered a slackening of fire in order to deceive the rebels into thinking that they had driven our batteries off or we had run out of ammunition while engaging in counter-battery fire. It was my plan to draw them in and let them have it before they got to the Emmitsburg Road with quantities of shot and shell. General Hancock, commanding the 2nd Corps, he felt that it was bad for the morale of his troops to have our guns silent while their guns were thundering away at us. Now, most of their I'm not going to say that they didn't inflict damage on us. They most certainly did to some extent. But most of their shells were landing long. Their shells were landing back along the Emmitsburg Road. Many of them were exploding short of target. They appeared to have had some difficulty with their fuses. So I saw no need to engage in what I felt was unproductive counter-battery fire. The air was very thick, hot. It was hot and humid that day. Every time a shell exploded, the smoke would linger over the target. Now, if I couldn't see what kind of damage our guns were inflicting upon the enemy, how could General Hancock? The truth is, he couldn't. He knew no more than I did what kind of damage we were inflicting upon them. He countermanded my order to cut our rate of fire. He ordered Captain Hazard, the artillery chief of the 2nd Corps, to continue pounding away at them. He also rode further south down the line, trying to entice guns outside of his own Corps to continue firing as well. Fortunately for me, he encountered Lieutenant Colonel Freeman McGilvery, one of the most gifted artillerists I have ever met. Despite the fact that he was not a career soldier, he was actually a sea captain. Colonel McGilvery stood there with his hands on his hips in defiance and told General Hancock essentially to go to the devil. He refused to follow his orders. This led to the depletion of our long-range ordnance along every gun, every ammunition chest, along the entire 2nd Corps. The 2nd Corps artillery could not open up on them until they crossed the Emmitsburg Road, in which case we had to load with canister. Now, canister, for those who are not aware of what canister is, it turns your cannon into a shotgun. Okay? Talking 27 iron balls about an inch in diameter, packed in a can with sawdust, and it disperses like a shotgun shell. That's a short-range weapon only. Inside of 200 yards, you then load with double canister. Fortunately, we had plenty of that. That, along with our infantry each man with men behind them. I believe each man had approximately 5 or 6 loaded rifles behind them. There were men at the back loading rifles and passing them forward. With our stores of canister and the infantry maintaining their rate of fire, this is how we were able to break up their assault and drive them off.
General, also, I understand several years before the war, a fellow named Samuel Morse came up with a system of communication with clicks over a wire. Did any of that type of science help you at any point in the war? Did you ever get any information in that way?
On the peninsula in 1862, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Thaddeus Lowe showed up with a balloon. What are we going to do with a balloon? Well, Dr. Lowe had devised a means of identifying enemy targets by means of this balloon. He would run a telegraph line. He would send an observer up along with somebody to operate the balloon. They would then tap out coordinates on a telegraph line. This is how we were able to direct artillery fire in dense forest. We were able to hit targets that we could not see by means of this balloon. Of course, this was very dangerous work for the balloon operator and the observer. The most dangerous part was coming down. You might want to know why is coming down more dangerous than going up. The balloon went up fairly quickly, and the enemy was often caught by surprise. By the time they saw it, they were able to get above the elevation of enemy artillery, and you were out of range of rifle fire. Coming down, however, they were ready for you. They were waiting. So the balloon would be cranked in. It was tethered to a rope, and you would hand crank the balloon in. All the while, you are coming under the range of rifle fire, and you're descending through exploding shot and shell. Very dangerous work.
Now, Major Letterman, I understand that your service in the military changed military medicine. You want to comment on that just briefly?
We reorganized medical services completely. First of all, we improved sanitation. We moved latrines far away from the camps, for example, and cut the incidence of intestinal diseases dramatically. And by the way, diseases killed far more men than battles during our War of the Rebellion. We also improved dietary standards. We added fresh fruits and vegetables and eliminated scurvy and some other nutritional diseases. We also completely reorganized military medicine. In the beginning of the war, each regiment had a regimental surgeon. And at least in the beginning of the war, they were mostly civilian physicians who had very little experience with the type of injuries that they were going to see. If your regiment was involved in battle, you were swamped. And if your regiment was not involved in battle, you had very little to do. In addition, if you were injured, you had to make your own way back to your own regimental surgeon, or your buddy, or a musician who had no other job, had to drag you back. And there was no organized system for evacuation. Consequently, the wounded were left on battlefield, sometimes for days, completely unattended. I organized a system whereby the regimental surgeons were eliminated and the medical service was organized into field dressing stations, field hospitals, and base hospitals in the cities behind the lines and a professional ambulance corps responsible to the medical services. Also, the medical supplies were taken away from the quartermaster and put under the jurisdiction of the medical services so they would have priority, even in time of war. So wounded were brought to the field dressing station with the, by professional ambulance corps. There was triage available very close to the scene of the battle, and the they would then be evacuated to the field hospital. So, for example, at Gettysburg, the field hospital was known to Camp Letterman, as Camp Letterman, which was several miles from the battle site on high ground where there was fresh water, close to rail transport, which is necessary to evacuate people to the hospitals in the cities. These measures reduced mortality by from battlefield injuries by 65 to 70%. It was quite dramatic. It was so much so that it was, before the war was over, it was adopted by all Union armies. Now, what's interesting is there were observers in the Union armies from Europe, and they observed this new system, which was referred to as the American system, and they brought it back to Europe. And adopted it in Europe, in all the European armies also, where they referred to it as the American system. Now, by the way, in this era, 1861 to 65, no medical advances were coming from America. They were all coming from Europe. So this was kind of unusual. And it eventually became the standard operating system for all armies in the world. So for example, at some point, we're going to have some kind of flying contraptions, like the whirly blades that will eventually replace horse-drawn ambulances, but the basic system remains intact. That is, every army in the world is basically on the system that I developed in 1863.
If I may, at this point, Dr. Letterman, you only have such a large staff. The staff cannot cover everything. Half of your men are out gathering up the wounded and bringing them back and so on. So they get volunteers from the people living in the town, and I want to tell one brief story about this young lady. She came in and spent literally weeks at the Camp Letterman hospital site, taking care of the men, feeding them, changing addressing their wounds, changing their clothes and everything, washing them down, doing all of this. If one of these men was well enough now to be transported to a hospital, she would go down with him to get him onto the train, and off they go. If one of the men died, she went down with him to the train. This volunteer was 9 years old.
We had a number of volunteers who were extremely helpful. We had our own orderlies assigned to the surgeons. We also, during the course of the war, developed a professional nursing corps, which was extraordinarily valuable. I can't say enough for these young women who served with distinction in the hospitals. If you look at Gettysburg as an example, during the 6 months Camp Letterman was in operation, we took care of 20,000 wounded, 12,000 Union and 8,000 Confederate, and I will say that we treated the Confederates with the same compassion and respect that we treated our own. As bad as things could have been much worse. I'll add one other parenthetical story, and that is the medical truce, and that is, although the first Geneva Convention was in place and had not been fully implemented, the non-combatant status of the medical service in green was recognized by both sides. I had meetings with my counterpart, the chief medical officer of the Army of Northern Virginia, and when Lee withdrew, I was given the location of the wounded that could not be moved, and he left them behind with volunteers and with some volunteer Confederate surgeons. And after the withdrawal, I took charge of all of them, moved them to Camp Letterman, made use of the Confederate surgeons as part of the process. So we not only serviced and saved our own men, but we did the same to the Confederates. And I would say during that entire battle, as is true most of the battles, the non-combatant status of the medical officers was recognized. And we were able to fulfill that mission.
General Meade, if I could ask you along the same lines, because of the large number of Confederate wounded that had to be cared for after the Battle of Gettysburg, did that large number affect the disposition of your troops in any way?
I was only concerned about pursuing Lee, and that was my only intention.
I didn't really have, I couldn't worry about, I had obviously, I was compassionate and concerned about the wounded of both sides, but I was not my main concern. My main concern was continuing to press Lee after his retreat. And so I was trying to maintain contact with scouts, find out what he was doing, and then once I finally obtained information I felt was reliable, that he was indeed retreating, and then I was going to put my army onto the march to pursue him, which I did well, I think, and it has been marked in history that I did pursue Lee and actually trapped him with his back to the rain-swollen Potomac River. But a set of circumstances intervened which allowed him to retreat across the river after I had planned to assault him on the 13th of July, and he retreated during the night and escaped into Virginia. But nevertheless, I felt good that I had done my best and had confronted him and pressed him, and I really couldn't be concerned about. So I left my wounded in the hands of Dr. Letterman. I had to take him along with me because he was needed with the Army, but he saw to the fact that many surgeons did remain, plus hundreds if not thousands of volunteers came in from the cities. Elizabeth Hutter from Philadelphia, and other thousands of volunteers who flocked to the city, the town. I was told this later, of course, to care for the wounded in all the various field hospitals, particularly Camp Letterman, but also the private homes and others that were provided. So I can't say that I was much concerned about the wounded because I had to get on to the with the business of fighting Lee.
Yeah. Sir. Well, hold on, sir. If you wait for the electric megaphone to reach
you. What happened after the Battle of Gettysburg with respect to at least the dead was the local blacks and the poorer people were relegated to pick up the bodies, mostly of dead horses, and bury them quickly.
Well,
and so wasn't
are you
pretty,
asking me, sir?
I'm not asking, I'm telling you.
Well, I was there. Were you?
Were you there afterwards for 6 or 7 weeks? Because that's how long it took.
Well, you're partially correct. The Union men were very assiduous about burying their own comrades. And so they put them under the ground very, very quickly.
There were many thousands.
And then we had emergency militia regiments that were recruited in Pennsylvania who were assigned the duty of gathering up the dead and burying them mostly very quickly in pits. But they were, for sanitary reasons, they were buried very quickly. The dead horses and mules were burned, again, for sanitary reasons. That took some time, that's true. But most of the dead were gathered up and buried fairly quickly, almost before we left. We departed, fully departed Gettysburg on July the 6th. So there were 3 days in which there was a lot of activity going on in burying the dead of both sides. Sir, yes, I know you. That is my great-grandson. Great.
Hold on 1 second. Let me.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm very interested that, of course, after Lee got away when the river, you know.
He was pressed.
Yes, you did a great job, but he got away because the river did subside, as most rivers do after rainstorms. But anyway, I'm curious because after that, you continued as the head of the Army of the Potomac, all the way to the end.
That's correct.
And as I recall, General Grant kind of followed the Army around, but kept his distance and would camp several miles away, for instance. Can you describe how well supported you felt by General Grant, or was he just sort of kept at a distance?
Do I have to answer this?
Yes, you do.
He is still my commander. General Grant was promoted to the newly instituted rank of Lieutenant General. Only one other officer had had that rank, the full rank, and that was George Washington.
No. Oh, no, that's not true.
By brevet, sir. By brevet, an honorary rank, not a true rank. And so, therefore, because he was the highest ranking officer in the Union Army, he automatically became the General in Chief. And when he did come east, he made it very clear he did not want to remain in Washington as General Halleck, who had kind of preceded him in that role, did. And because he was a field commander in his own right, and he also saw the future of the war being decided on the field against Lee's army, he made it very clear that he was going to put his headquarters in the field. You are correct. And so I was in command at that point of the Army of the Potomac. My headquarters was located in Culpeper County, Virginia. And he arrived on March the 10th, 1864, I'll never forget that day, to interview me. Now, I had known him slightly in the Mexican War. He was kind of distinguished staff officer and engineer. Since no one else will say it, I suppose I have. And he was a quartermaster, and of course we know what, no one in the Army likes quartermasters because they're stingy. They distribute tin cups and other things, of course. I'm joking a little. It is April. No, I'm sorry, it's May. I'm sorry, I almost said it's April 1st. So I couldn't remember him. I couldn't recall. I knew that he had been there. But nevertheless, he had been appointed to command, and therefore, as a loyal officer of long service, I felt that it was important. The government had appointed him, and therefore he deserved full obedience. And there were also rumors about that he wanted to replace me with a man that he knew and with confidence in, and so on. And so when he came to my tent, after he criticized my staff flag, that's another story, I said to General Grant, congratulations on your promotion, and I want to let you right now that if you want to replace me with somebody that is perfectly all right with me, it's fine. It's not about me and my career. It's only about the cause. I'm paraphrasing. And he was taken aback, I think, because I don't know how many other generals would have said that. And so he said, no, I want you to stay. I admire your victory at Gettysburg. You know the Army. They have confidence in you. And therefore, I would like you to remain in that position. And I said, General, in that case, I will accept. And thank you for the offer. But I realized it would be a difficult, intense situation because you can't have two commanders of the same army. And so I always tried to be totally and completely obedient and complicit with all his demands. He did ask me for advice. Sometimes he took it, sometimes he didn't. Was his headquarters right next to mine? No. Most of the time it was separated. He wanted to keep some separation. But it was close. And sometimes we were together, right? I mean, for example, the day of the surrender proceedings, April 9th, he had spent the evening with me in the same building. And we had breakfast together on April the 9th, early in the morning. And he said to me, already white flags had been going through the lines. We knew that it was near, that Lee was close to surrender. He had been asking for terms. And so I was quite disappointed when General Grant said to me, well, I'm going to leave you and go around to the other side of the army. And I thought, oh gosh, I knew because wherever he was, that's where the action would be taking place. And so I said, fine, thank you very much. And he said, by the way, if any flags come through the lines, you know, try to get me a message and let me know what's going on. And so he left and he was riding around to the Army of the James, which was behind me. And on the way, he was found by Confederate staff officers from Lee and told that the arrangements had been made. He was requested to come into the courthouse and meet Lee for deliberations. And of course, he had left me behind. And so I wasn't there during the proceedings, and that's why. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. On the other hand, did you feel comfortable that he had confidence in you throughout, or was that?
I think, yes, we got along very well. We were amicable, is that the right word? Yes. And I think he respected me and my position. I was a much older, more experienced officer, an engineer. And of course, the engineers at the elite of the Army, I have to say it again, I'm sorry. He knew that I knew the Army well. I had served continuously with the Army of the Potomac. He was not an insider, he was an outsider coming in from outside. And sometimes creates tension and
yes, and now you know why they had to make me a brevet major general to ride herd on this. I merely went to differ with my fellow officer to one extent. I was chief of staff to a Lieutenant General Winfield Scott, so there were three, sir. It was George Washington, Winfield Scott, and then I think Ulysses Grant for Lieutenant General.
Scott was a brevet Lieutenant General.
Yes. For an awful long time.
Check it out.
Washington was a Lieutenant General in the Continental Army.
Right.
That was adopted.
Okay. Now, I also want to say here, in order to be totally fair, while we do not have the pleasure of having General Grant here, we do have his chief of staff here, and I think that the chief of staff should be allowed to make his comment.
Okay, first of all, I was not chief of staff, I was aide-de-camp. General John Rawlins was the chief of staff. However, as General Meade said, General Grant did have confidence in him. They did call on him to get opinions on certain situations coming up. He took some. He rejected some. I think the one situation that I can recall was there was an argument between General Sheridan and General Meade. General Meade was just about ready to shoot General Sheridan, I believe.
He deserved?
Probably.
Insubordination in the field of battle?
Absolutely. A very arrogant situation, but General Grant asked what was it about, and General Meade says, well, General Sheridan says he could take the cavalry and go out and do all sorts of things, and General Grant said, he said that? Let him do it. If he doesn't succeed.
He left the expletives out.
Yes, but, you know, so occasionally there was a difference of opinion, but and there always will be when you have generals together who have the experience that these men have had. But General Grant did respect General Meade. And
my impression, General Meade, is that he did have confidence in you and that he did delegate the most battlefield decisions to you.
On occasion.
I've been informed.
Not on every occasion.
I've been informed now that we have.
Cite one example: Cold Harbor. I was against that suicide attack assault, and in fact, I believe sometime in the future, Grant is going to write his memoirs, and I think he's going to express his regret at ordering that assault suggestion.
My ability to control space and time apparently is coming to an end, and we have time for one more question, sir.
Florence Nightingale had been around for a while when the Civil War broke out. Did her experience and reports of her experience have any influence on?
She did have an influence. I didn't ever have a chance to meet her, and I wasn't that involved with nursing, but she did come over to the United States, I believe, and she had an influence in Clara Barton starting really what became the start of our nursing corps. You know, one of the ways I disagreed also with Dr. Letterman is, yes, the women nurses were allowed to become nurses in the hospitals and treat the wounded, but it was male nurses only that were on the battlefield, and women, unless they were doing it illegally, were not allowed to work on the battlefield during that time.
No, they were instrumental in the base hospitals. You couldn't have run them without them. They were not brought to the battlefield for good reason. Women should be brought to the battlefield. They have no business there. Well, that's part of the reason. That's part of the reason women shouldn't be doctors.
And on that note, that note of amity and comedy, I want to thank you all for being here. And again, now that we have returned to this rather plebeian time in the 21st century, I again want to repeat that the URL for this group is uniongenerals.org. I am truly in awe of the men and women to my right here. They are true scholars, and I encourage you to take the opportunity not only to speak to us here, but to visit us as we have other activities throughout this area. We are always willing and welcome to see and speak to all of you. Thank you very much.